you go charging by. We'll send up our cheers to the sky.
The Hurricane Helene, a product of climate change or environmental modification technology? Is there more to global warming than system-wide burning of fossil fuels? Is it a coincidence that current financial climate solutions advantage the very wealthy at the expense of average humans? Who is Mark Carney, and why is he poised to move from the UN Special Envoy for Climate Action and Finance to Trudeau's successor as Prime Minister of Canada? This week on the Global Research News Hour, with the 29th UN Conference of the Parties underway, preparing to save the day for the planet, we host an analysis of some of the factors other than fossil fuels influencing global climate change, and also take a look at what major financial eco-warriors are really doing behind the curtain of mainstream media spotlight. In our first half hour, we hear a report by Greg Reese on the probable use of NMOD strategies and the motive of supplying the U.S. with access to lithium that was responsible for the devastation in North Carolina last month. We hear from writer-blogger Dmitry Orlov on the cause of climate change as rooted in the heavens rather than the earth. And in our final half hour, Matthew Arrett, editor-in-chief of the Canadian Patriot Review, joins us to discuss the rise of Canadian banker Mark Carney and his role in forging ahead with a world government and the depopulation of the planet. On this week's program, COP29, the great reset of the climate apocalypse, taxing the people to feed the banks. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 15th, 2024. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji, Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The resources shared between First Nations and settlers came via broken treaties, faulty promises, and force, all of which contributed to colonialism and genocide of Indigenous people. And we seek to correct these injustices moving forward through acknowledging the crimes, reparations, and reconciliation and moving forward with mutual respect and partnership. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. We see a clip of JFK himself condemning the U.S. support of the Cuban dictator Batista, who was finally overthrown by Fidel Castro and his rebel compatriots, the Cuban Revolution that Kennedy understood and sympathized with. All this just leading up to Kennedy's presidency, which will be covered in the next film. Watching this riveting documentary, one cannot but be deeply impressed with a side of John Kennedy few know, his hatred of oppression, colonialism, imperialism, war, and his love of freedom for all people. One comes away from the film knowing full well why the CIA had branded him an arch enemy even before he took office, and then when in office he rattled their cage so much more in the cause of peace. And one is left asking, why then has this film and its predecessor about the right-wing witch hunt and crackdown on dissent in the 1950s, not been released to the public at a time when nothing could be more timely? That comes from the article, John F. Kennedy, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Robert F. Kennedy, A Bizarre Kind of Executive Action, The Suppression of Epochal Documentaries, Edward Curtin. By Edward Curtin, posted November 14th, originally published on the author's blog site, Behind the Curtain. Here comes a relatively simple solutions for the three world powers, Washington, Russia, Beijing, to act in unison and to stop the killing, destruction, and misery at once. Now that the U.S. ultimatum expired, these three world powers could simply occupy Israel with minimal casualties, block deliveries of fuel, food, medication, water supply, much of which belongs to Palestine anyway, and of course weapons and money, all blocked at once. From one day to the other, the killing would stop. Or is somebody telling the world that there are powers, obviously Zionists or Zionist-associated supremacies, that are above the United States, Russia, and China? That comes from the article, Appeal to the Superpowers, Stop the Zionist-Israeli Genocide at Once, by Peter Koenig, posted November 14th. Even within the imperialist states, such as the U.S., Britain, and the European Union, or EU, countries, there is growing support for the cause of the Palestinians. Demonstrations demanding the full disclosure and disinvestment from Israel and those conducting business with the racist regime are involving millions of youths and workers. The concluding declaration of the Arab League OIC meeting encompassed 38 resolutions, two of which read, quote, to start working to mobilize international support to suspend Israel's participation in the United Nations General Assembly and all its affiliated entities in preparation for submitting a joint draft resolution to the General Assembly, the 10th Special Session, Uniting for Peace, on the basis of its violations of the United Nations Charter, its threat to international peace and security, and its failure to fulfill its membership in the United Nations, and based on the advisory opinion issued by the International Court of Justice on July 19, 2024, to call on all countries to ban the export or transfer of weapons and ammunition to Israel, urging countries to join the initiative proposed by the Republic of Turkey and the core group consisting of 18 countries, which was signed by 52 countries, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the League of Arab States, and to send a joint letter to the UN Security Council, the President of the UN General Assembly, and the UN Secretary General, to halt the provision of arms to Israel and to invite all countries to sign it, unquote. That comes from the article, Joint Extraordinary Summit between the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the Arab League calls for embargo against Israel, by Abayomi Azikiwe, posted November 14th. The jury awarded a total of $42 million to three Iraqi men, a journalist, a middle school principal, and fruit vendor, who were held at the notorious prison two decades ago. The plaintiff's suit accused Virginia-based Khaki, which was hired by the U.S. government to provide interrogation services at Abu Ghraib, of conspiring with American soldiers to torture detainees. Tuesday's verdict marks a rare victory for plaintiffs seeking to bring American corporations to justice for playing a part in the country's so-called war on terror. What the jury did today is send a very clear message that the contractors who go to war or go work with the government overseas, they will be held accountable for their role in whatever violations their employees may commit, said Catherine Gallagher, senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, which represented the plaintiffs at a press conference on Tuesday afternoon. They need to have far better oversight over their employees to ensure that something like what happened at Abu Ghraib never happens again. That comes from the article, Abu Ghraib detainees awarded $42 million in torture trial against Virginia-based Khaki, by Sanya Mansour, posted November 14th, originally published on The Intercept. Trump values loyalty above all else. In the 2020 race, Netanyahu publicly supported Joe Biden and urged the thousands of U.S. citizens living in Israel to vote for Biden. Trump may make demands on Netanyahu for a peace plan for Palestine, which Smotrich and Ben-Gvir refuse, which will be followed by the collapse of the Netanyahu coalition. Netanyahu would then face prison for his corruption conviction, and a new Israeli government would be formed. A new Israeli government post-Netanyahu might be willing to compromise for Israeli peace and security, and a two-state solution would be possible. That comes from the article Trump's Partner for Peace in the Middle East by Stephen Swahini, posted November 14th, originally published on Mideast Discourse. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The 29th Annual Conference of the Parties of the United Nations Framework on Combating Climate Change began on Monday, November 11th, and was hosted in Baku, Azerbaijan. One of the achievements of the first week was the reaching of a consensus on the creation of carbon credits under Article 6.4 of the Paris Agreement, thereby ensuring demand for carbon credits and ushering in an international carbon market. Carbon markets are seen as a way of establishing a trading system where carbon credits are sold and bought. If a company or individual produces too much carbon dioxide, they can purchase a carbon credit from another company or individual that has effectively reduced or removed the same amount of greenhouse gas emissions. Carbon financing is considered the key to the implementation of national determined contributions, or NDCs. There is demand for carbon markets. Greenhouse gas warming is seen as the main and only factor in climate change and carbon markets. It is argued is the answer to addressing it, but other factors are not really considered. One factor that is not mentioned at all in modern climate talks is environmental modification techniques, or NMOD. These techniques do exist and have been applied by the U.S. military for more than half a century. There was even a convention in 1977 on the use of NMOD, banning military or hostile use of environmental modification techniques having widespread, long-lasting, or severe effects. Can we really assume these powerful techniques are not mentioned in light of current dramatic meteorological events such as hurricanes? On October 2nd, writer and researcher Greg Reese put together a report for InfoWars on the history of the U.S. officially learning how to steer hurricanes. He mentions that Project Cirrus, run by General Electric and supported by the U.S. military, was the first official attempt to modify a hurricane by seeding the wall outside of the eye with compounds like silver iodide. On October 13th, 1947, a hurricane headed out to sea was seeded with 180 pounds of dry ice. Modification was observed, and the hurricane shifted direction, landing on Savannah, Georgia. In 1965, a similar operation, Project Storm Fury, targeted Hurricane Betsy, and again it changed direction and landed in Southern California. Now, importantly, in 1997, U.S. Defense Secretary William Cohen admitted to the use of technology for controlling not only weather, but earthquakes and volcanoes. The U.S. government put a gag order on employees of the National Weather Service. Another hurricane, Hurricane Sandy, in 2012, had weakened to a tropical storm, but microwave technology reveals a thick red beam followed by Sandy strengthening to a Category 1 hurricane and again shifting toward New Jersey. Enter Hurricane Helene. Last month, it was steered toward King Mountain in North Carolina. North Carolina is believed to be one of the biggest resources of lithium in the world, at a time when there is a kind of gold rush for this mineral for fueling alternative energy sources to fossil fuels. According to a reporter, people don't want to leave the town, and it's considered a divisive issue among the small, quiet town of Cherryville. It is interesting that the previous year, 2023, the Department of Defense secured a $90 million agreement with Albemarle Corporation to increase domestic production of lithium for the nation's battery supply chain, specifically from King Mountain, to start in 2025. How did the Department of Defense know a disaster would strike the community and force everyone out? There is another researcher who has expressed doubts about carbon dioxide as the prime culprit in global warming. Dmitry Orlov emigrated from Russia, where he was born, to the United States in the mid-1970s. He's moved back to Russia in recent years. He is the author of Shrinking the Technosphere, Getting a Grip on the Technologies That Limit Our Autonomy, Self-Sufficiency, and Freedom, and The Five Stages of Collapse, Survival's Toolkit. And he blogs at boosty.to/clubOrlov. I engaged him in conversation recently about his current hypothesis and efforts by elites to usher in carbon markets under the guise of protecting the planet.
A lot of talk about how we're going to get carbon dioxide under control to protect the planet from global warming. And it seems as if you too were concerned about this theory of climate change when you wrote the Shrinking the Technosphere. Yet you recently, the last couple of years, you revised your analysis of the global warming and concluded that increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was not the main cause of rising temperatures. What exactly was it that caused you to change your views?
What caused me to change my views was moving from the United States, where anything that contradicts the global warming carbon dioxide hypothesis — it's not a theory, it's a hypothesis — is basically taboo and gets you shunned. Moving to Russia, where just about anything can be discussed, and where scientists are more free to speak their minds, although not on paper, because they don't want to be shunned internationally. After all, this global warming mafia is really quite powerful. Now, the whole scheme was that the West, or the developed countries of the West, would pursue the strategy of using solar and wind, which only they would be able to afford, and which would be successfully used, whereas the rest of the world would muddle along with fossil fuels and would be heavily fined for doing so, for causing quote-unquote global warming or catastrophic climate change or something like that. And in order to support this juggernaut, all kinds of scientific forgeries were committed and are being committed. Now, the way it turned out was that the solar panels and the wind generators all had to be Chinese made, and they're non-renewable resources because they have to be renewed quite regularly by the Chinese. If the Chinese don't sell the equipment or the precursors to the equipment, which is a lot of rare earths that only the Chinese have, then no more renewable energy. And then Western countries also committed all kinds of grave errors, such as getting rid of nuclear, such as shutting down pipelines from Russia to the West, and generally trying to get rid of Russian exports, energy exports, which just basically means that Russian oil goes through India now at a markup. So they did all sorts of ridiculous things. But in terms of the global warming hypothesis and the idea that carbon dioxide, atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations are a leading as opposed to a trailing phenomenon of global warming, You know, that's just a hypothesis. It hasn't been proven. It's not a very good hypothesis. The most potent global warming gas is water vapor, which is very badly, clouds, that is, which is very badly modeled in all of these catastrophist models of global warming. And carbon dioxide, it just isn't very, very effective. And the other thing, the thing that absolutely kills all of these claims that higher carbon dioxide concentrations have raised the temperature, is that the temperature has gone up on other planets as well, on which there is no carbon dioxide and no humans and no industry. And so that would point out to some kind of a space-related source of radiation, which heated up planetary cores. And the Russians have also done some research because they're afraid of being ostracized. Unfortunately, it's been circulated but unpublished. That the warming on Earth has been from the core of the planet. That is, the ocean is warming throughout its depth, which is not what you expect from atmospheric warming. And so all of that put together just basically means that this COP initiative and the rest of this global warming carbon dioxide juggernaut that is still being pursued by the West is basically just a complete and total disaster.
Yeah, well, you know, it seems as if, I mean, maybe the idea of peer-reviewed paper literature and scientific journalism is elevated in my mind here in the Anglo-American West, but I don't know, like they say there's a 99% consensus of human activities causing climate change. I don't know, as somebody who's been in the sciences yourself, how do you, I don't know, defend being a member of this extreme minority of scientists? I mean, how is it that this peer-reviewed system does not necessarily align with your thoughts and on all the evidence that you point to?
Well, first of all, I don't have to defend it. You can take it or leave it. Secondly, you don't really have to get into the details of who these peers are to point out the really obvious thing, which is climate science is boring. Climate just changes, and nobody knows why, and there's no way to explain it. And so it's a waste of time to study it, because it's basically you're just recording what's going on without any ability to explain it. But if you want to get some grants, then you have to talk up climate catastrophism. So anybody who is in climate science is a climate catastrophist, or they don't get served lunch. That's how science works in the West. So they're a bunch of lunch eaters. And of course, that they're going to tell you that the climate is going to the dogs and we are to blame, because that's what they get paid to do.
Yeah, well, you suggest in your hypothesis, suggesting that the planet is warming from the core and not from the atmosphere. I mean, is there a bit of research that confirms that, or like a certain paper that was written? I mean, what was?
Yeah, there's plenty of research, but nobody's going to put their name to it because we know how the system works. Science is an international pursuit. And the thing is that all of the people who control access happen to be in the West and happen to be in on it. So there's research, but it's not going to be published in a way that you will accept for obvious political reasons.
Okay. In terms of the, I guess, the space-based, like you mentioned, the other planets were heating up. I mean, what exactly is that, the source of that space-based event? Is it something from the sun or something beyond? What I mean, I know it's still a hypothesis, but what would cause something like that?
Well, the warming effect, the pulse, is observable and has been measured. It's hard to measure it on the outer planets, but it's been recorded on the Moon, on Mars, and on Venus. Nobody knows what exactly happened because nobody was tooled up to actually measure the particle flux as it happened. But chances are that it's an increased neutrino flux that could be from that it probably is from outside the solar system. There are various mechanisms, some understood, such as a supernova, some much worse understood, that cause increases in neutrino flux for periods of time. And it's notoriously difficult to observe because neutrinos don't really interact with matter very much. So that is one theory that's been proposed, but this is not something that happens very often. It seems to have run its course already. Nobody observed it while it was happening, and now it seems to be over.
Yeah. Well, given all of this, why would you suggest that carbon and fossil fuels are such a major focus of these UN climate change policies? I mean, what's you know, enacting that and has been for some time, like going back to, you know, more than 30 years?
Oh, it's very simple. You know, these countries that are behind this effort still feel like they can control the whole world. And the idea was that, well, we in the West have the capacity to shift to quote-unquote renewables. As I explained, they aren't renewable. They're renewable by the Chinese for money. They wear out. They thought that they could shift to renewables and be these magic elves that don't emit carbon dioxide, and then everybody else in the world who have to burn whatever's available in order to cook their dinner could be taxed for doing so and fined. And so the West is always looking for ways to rob the rest of the planet, and this was just one of them.
So you guess things like the carbon, there's a carbon market now where you basically have, you could use the certain plants as ways of as being mitigants to fossil fuel production. So we're still producing fossil fuels anyway, but we're growing a certain plant, and that way we're, you know, contributing this to this carbon market, and that's that in itself has certain implications, right?
Yeah, well, the biggest implication of that is that Russia would be the biggest recipient of money from this carbon market because Russia has the most boreal forest in the world, and so it is capturing more carbon dioxide than the rest of the planet put together. So just take all your money and send it to Russia, and since that plan didn't really appeal to Western countries, Russia had to somehow be finessed or excluded.
Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure interacting with you again, Dmitry. Thank you for joining us and sharing your analysis with our listeners.
Thank you.
Dmitry Orlov is the author of Shrinking the Technosphere, Getting a Grip on the Technologies That Limit Our Autonomy, Self-Sufficiency, and Freedom, and Five Steps of Collapse, Survivor's Toolkit, as well as Reinventing Collapse, the Soviet Experience and American Prospects.
Dmitry Orlov lives in St. Petersburg.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
A figure on the world stage who is a major architect of a climate-friendly solution to the way the financial system works is Mark Carney. He works as the Special Envoy for Climate Action and Finance. He was the former chair of the Bank of England and the Bank of Canada. And he may soon replace Justin Trudeau as the next leader of the Liberal Party of Canada. But in a September 12th article written by Matthew Errett, Carney is a major figure at the helm of orchestrating the Great Reset that would alter the whole way that the global financial system works, and not for large segments of the working class with aims to that have nothing to do with healing the planet. Is Mark Carney a climate sheep in profit predator bankers' wolf's clothing? Matthew Arrett is the editor-in-chief of the Canadian Patriot Review, senior fellow at the American University in Moscow, and director of the Rising Tide Foundation. He has written the four-volume Untold History of Canada series, a four-volume Clash of the Two Americas series, and the Science Unshackled, Restoring Casualty to a World in Chaos. He's also the co-host of the Multipolar Reality on Rogue News and Breaking History on Badlands Media. It's good to have you back. Thanks again for joining us, Matt.
It's always a pleasure to join you, Michael. I'm looking forward to today's chat.
So for years, environmental activists have said that we have to stop investing in
that was
financial
our show on climate change.
Financing
join us next week
fuel industries that are ravaging the earth and invest
in
instead
Canada
in new technologies such as
Israel,
solar
NATO
and wind power, green solutions.
And
Mark Carney has played a major role in developing financial tools and in responding positively to these changes, or so we think. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think it comes down to intention and who, cui bono, who benefits by how. Like everybody, you know, would agree that we want a nice, clean earth where we don't want to pave over all of the trees on the globe in you know, favor of just making a concrete jungle. However, there's a dishonesty in how this particular model is being advanced by Carney and those very powerful players who have been at the helm of the destruction of nature. And here I'm referring to the Bilderberger Group, which Mark Carney is a frequent Bilderberg member, representing the largest multinational corporations that have systemically worked to undermine the sovereign nation state over the past decades, really throughout the entirety of the Cold War into the present. And institutions like the World Economic Forum, which Mark Carney is a trustee, a board member, as is Chrystia Freeland, and the major financial cartels that are centered today as they were even a century ago in the city of London, which, you know, the Bank of England being at the helm of much of this banker's global dictatorship that has overseen so much of the most disastrous actions, both on the pollution front, but also on just the war-making front, for so long. Carney was the governor of the Bank of England for 7 years, before that the governor of the Bank of Canada. And I think what it comes down to is, if you really scrutinize the argument and the solutions to how to define the problem of global pollution, the climate issues that are being proposed by the likes of Carney, they will, if we go along with his approach, result in the vast destruction to the quality of lives of the vast majority of people who are living under this elite Bilderberger-run agenda. Windmills, solar panels are not only insufficient at sustaining the lives of the 8 billion people that we currently have, as far as the needs for high-end, to have 8 billion people, first of all, requires extensive productive powers in the agro and industrial sectors. You have to have a lot of energy, a high quality of energy, to be able to sustain that level of production. Windmills and solar panels just simply do not cut it. You cannot produce industrial quality steel at the scales needed to sustain current population levels. And additionally, they're very destructive to nature. The amount of destructive mining of the raw material, the lithium, the cobalt, the rare earths that go into creating a solar panel that is itself absolutely not even recyclable. These things are toxic waste hazards for as long as, if not longer in many cases, than much of the worst propaganda against nuclear waste. So, you know, you have so many destructive effects, which I think are sort of the purpose of this new type of global green economy that Mark Carney is the eco-banker or the eco-warrior of central bankers that he's been championed. I think they want that effect. of the reduction of global populations, the reduction of our ability to have abundance, and ultimately things that are going to clear crop forests. If you look at the type of energy policies that they expect out of the new society they want to bring online that's totally dependent on windmills and especially solar panels, it requires the cutting down of vast troves of trees, of forests across the Midwest, even across South America, in order to place and even farmland that they want to transform into simply solar farms, which was formerly food-producing areas, which will increase heat because the solar panels, when you have a solar farm, it increases the general heat of an area that increases itself desertification. So they're going to be destroying life. It's really, the effect is going to be a destruction of the ecosystems of the Earth by doing this. Mm-hmm. So it's just wrong on so many levels.
Yeah, it seems like you're suggesting that this whole the response on the part of, I guess, what's COP29 as it's coming along, and all of the climate solutions, it's more of a kind of a Hegelian thing, the problem action solution, and the solution is already something that's that they don't emphasize all the toxic impacts of all the things that you're saying in the name of stopping this evil climate change scenario. I know that most of the increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is actually produced by the world's richest people, and yet the Green New Deal reforms are actually, in the words of the Great Reset, that will cover for the, as you say, for the global depopulation and the world government. Will be run by the same arsonists, if you will, who lit the world economy on fire in the first place. Could you get it? Maybe how this new version of capitalism will affect changes not in the best interest of the common man and woman.
Yeah, well, I mean, amongst those things that Mark Carney has proposed. And he's outright threatened. He basically said with his task force on climate-related financial disclosures that he co-created with Michael Bloomberg, who headed it formerly before him, and also Mario Draghi, another vicious technocrat, lover of austerity. These individuals who represent the most vicious of the oligarchical class have put forth things like that, and part of the program that Carney has put forth when he was heading that involved a direct threat, saying that any company internationally that adapts to this new green set of standards that will involve new green indices for virtuous investing, this is all tied to touch the Council on Inclusive Capitalism, overseen currently patronized by King Charles III, who was the person selected to announce and usher in the Great Reset in the first place back in June of 2020, they will be rewarded handsomely. And he said, in a quote I'm paraphrasing, those who fail to make the proper adaptions to the new green standards will cease to exist. And he did this in an essay titled 50 Shades of Green, which is a bit of a sick joke. It's a reference to a sadomasochistic propaganda book series of 50 Shades of Grey, implying a pleasure in pain, right? That the dominator over the victim receives pleasure in the pain that they give, and the person being dominated receives pleasure in the pain they receive. So there's a very sick, I think, ideology behind the technocrats pushing this green agenda, because they know it's going to cause a vast amount of suffering and pain. And there's a pleasure that they get out of imposing it in a sick, sociopathic way. And they expect people to be brainwashed enough to take pleasure in adapting to scarcity. And that's a big theme, has been expecting the plebeians to learn how to enjoy adapting to scarcity, to eat the bugs and enjoy it. Stop, break with our traditions of expecting to own things and instead just rent things from the billionaire class, who will now own the things that we rent, in a way to reduce our climate impact, to get off of automobiles, right, which we're also being told that automobiles are, there's a big pressure right now to make them illegal in the sense of having any type of petroleum-based car illegal. It will be illegal, according to current plans, to manufacture such things in the coming years ahead. And instead, you know, they want people to be on bike rentals or maybe, you know, one electric car for a 15-minute city that has, you know, for every 100 people living in a 15-minute city building to be able to rent one electric car that can maybe go a very short distance. And nobody will own a car, especially not a car that, that burns fuel. So they, Carney's idea of creating this new type of economy involves such things like green bonds is one idea he's pushed that I think they're bringing about, which is a perversion of the old victory bonds of World War II, which were very important and good ideas when they're based upon a paradigm of supporting increasing production. It's a fine thing, and that did allow Canada to do the job of winning World War II against fascism, was we bought bonds from the Bank of Canada that were tied to projects that increased our society's productive power, created real high-quality jobs, and that's fine. Now Carney's trying to revive that victory bond idea, but infused with the idea of green bonds that would be associated with new credits tied to actions that, when engaged upon, would reduce, not increase the abundance, but would actually increase scarcity and constrict humanity's ability to support itself through things that involve monetary incentive on activities that will reduce population potential. And they're calling for, you know, something like $120 or even more trillion dollars needed for a global Green New Deal. But that can only happen under the conditions of a breakdown of the current financial system of the transatlantic, which I think Carney and those of his ilk understand is going to happen. There will be a financial breakdown that will accelerate very, very quickly. We've been living through it. It's already accelerating, but that real, what do you call it, bifurcation moment is yet to hit us. But when it does, it will come so heavy and so hard and so destructively that people will be so traumatized that they will accept, after a period of pain, of course, almost anything to feed their families once more. And that almost anything is what Carney and those Bilderberger groups group members are preparing right now as their solution, as you said, to, in their Hegelian dialectic of create the crisis and then introduce the solution to the chaos, which is actually more of the problem in a more virulent way than we ever realized, as far as a new fascist type of system of governance with a technocratic managerial elite devoted to the prospect of population reduction and consolidating power for the governing class that killed our leaders, that orchestrated our wars, that created all of these problems artificially over the last decades. So that's how I see Carney and this new green finance system that they're infusing directly into the COP29. The whole purpose of the COP summits was to bring about this thing. And this current COP summit, as you pointed out as well, is going to be dealing a lot with finance. So Carney will be playing a big role in this this year's summit. And it has a lot to do with the fact that many of the poor countries that have been abused by empire for so long are being told to lower their already very low living standards across Africa, many of the colonialized countries of the world, when they didn't even cause the climate issues to begin with. And now they're being told to suffer. They're thus not playing along with it. They're not accepting a lot of these conditions. Many African countries are rebelling, saying that they would rather industrialize and work with countries that don't have this death cult mentality, like China, which is offering, or even Saudi Arabia at this point, which is offering a lot of investments to let these countries use the resources, the petroleum and other things under their soil, the coal, for the benefit of the people living in Africa, which need infrastructure. They need to increase their productive powers.
Let me just stop you there, if I may. Sure. Yeah, because I think a major, as you point out, I mean, a major concern of the COP29 summit is going to be financing and making sure that the global South countries in particular are, have a kind of a more of leeway than – and I'm wondering, I mean, are you saying essentially that – with Carney himself, the major architect coming from the Anglo-American sphere, he was a banker and so forth. Is it truly going to result in an equalizing things in any way, or are we going to see things turning for the worse, for bad to worse?
If this is permitted to go ahead, it will certainly make things absolutely worse. they're trying to throw money. I don't think it's going to work because their approach is to try to just basically bribe and throw a lot of money financially at these developing countries in the global south as a way to bribe them into accepting this type of new set of standards for humanity, which will maybe enrich ever more a certain elite class within those countries, and maybe give them a certain amount of leeway where they could produce a little bit more CO2 than other economies that will have more intolerant restrictions on how much CO2 they can produce. But then you have all of these schemes as well for those mega behemoth corporations that want to produce more than their allotted quotas of carbon dioxide, which has become the demonized molecule in this whole story. And I think it's been falsely demonized in large measure when you look at the science behind climate change and the almost non-existent role of the carbon dioxide molecule in driving global climate, which I think is a huge scandal that should be addressed. But they're saying, oh, okay, if you want to produce more than your quota, you can buy it from poor countries that are not producing enough to even get close to the quota that's been allotted to them, so they can make more money by selling off their unused climate or carbon dioxide quotas to polluting corporations or states, mostly corporations. And then they'll make more money, and money somehow makes things better. And it's like, no, what makes things better is nations having sovereign governments capable of defending their people and providing the full spectrum economies needed to really stand on their own two feet. That's what's needed, and that's what's not permitted under the system either of globalization that turned our once viable Western economies into a time bomb of speculative debt and consumerism, or the thing that they're trying to prepare after for the replacement of globalization, which was never designed to be a forever model. It was always designed to become a time bomb that would blow up in order to usher in a crisis and thus a new system. That was always the design from the earliest days of the 70s, when people like Henry Kissinger and Neil Malthusian and all of the Neil Malthusians around David Rockefeller took control of the U.S. government over the dead body of Bobby Kennedy. They were always committed to setting up a new system that would be based upon what Zbigniew Brzezinski called the technotronic era, the era of the technocrat at post-democratic. And that's what they're trying to usher in now. So, no, it would not benefit poor countries at all if they go along with this.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch, and my special guest is Matthew Ederett, who's the author and journalist working in Montreal. Matt, I wonder if you could just give our listeners a bit of a brief bio of the man himself, Mark Carney. What brought this boy from Fort Smith, Northwest Territories, all of a sudden to calling the shots on global financing?
Well, that's a weird story. And as you said, he's like just this boy from butthell nowhere in Canada. And all of a sudden, he finds himself as an investment banker for Goldman Sachs, which, by the way, Mark Carney has also celebrated Goldman Sachs as being one of the green good banks that should be a role model for the world. So it shows you how this man is actually thinking, considering what we know Goldman Sachs to actually be, and if people are not totally politically naive. Very soon thereafter, he was appointed to become governor of the Bank of Canada, where a certain mystique was built up around him, around his persona as sort of the character who saved Canada from the financial crisis of 2008-2009 and kept us strong and stable with our conservative banking culture. And so, again, a lot of propaganda was built up to sort of celebrate him as the man who saved Canada, which gave him such prestige that he was then granted access to become the governor of the Bank of England, which he did from 2013 to 2020. During that time, he was the head of the task force on financial related disclosures. Additionally, as I said, he's been a leading Bilderberger member. He's a member of the Rockefeller Group's Council of 30, a very elite grouping of, I would say, sociopathic elites. His wife also, Diane Carney, is a player of relevance, and she was actually a co-founder of the Canada 2020 think tank set up in 2003 as an operation to usher in Justin Trudeau as a political figure, sold to the population almost as the heir to his father, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, and effectively brought in as a puppet leader that was finally done in 2013, or, you know, or when he became an MP, and then 2015 when he became prime minister. So you have this whole operation which operates kind of like, you know, wannabe sorcerers playing a magic show for dim-witted Canadians who don't really know their history. Most Canadians are very ignorant by design over the nature of how decisions and policies are made in Canada, including I don't know any Canadians who could properly tell me or who have been able to tell me what they think of as the role of the Privy Council office or the deputy ministers. Who are not elected but appointed and are handlers of many of the elected cases within our government. The Privy Council itself, most people don't understand it. They don't understand the lieutenant governors and the structure around them that's tied to the City of London. And frankly, also Mark Carney is one of the four presidents of the Royal Institute for International Affairs, which in my assessment is the queen of all global think tanks. It's the mothership of the Council on Foreign Relations. Its branch in Canada is Canada International Council, set up in the 1920s to advance the Cecil Rhodes agenda of undoing nation states and rebuilding a new globally extended British Empire above all nations of the earth. And that was the Cecil Rhodes program with who created the Rhodes Trust, the Rhodes Scholars, which, by the way, Chrystia Freeland is a leading Rhodes Scholar, as was Bob Ray and many other very, very negative forces, let's just say that, who interface closely with the Oxford-trained Mark Carney. And I think that a big part of his initiation into his mission in life came out of his experience in Oxford before he went into Goldman Sachs, as did Chrystia Freeland around the same time, and they both worked very closely together.
Wow.
So I think that these are all factors that shape the man that is Mark Carney, the eco-warrior of central bankers.
I guess that's my next question is that, why would he be seeking to... because as you stated right in your article that he's going to replace Trudeau as leader of the party. And I mean, he's, you know, after being a kind of a puppeteer, you know, because all of these people that you mentioned are so far like puppets, essentially. Why would he consent to being a mere prime minister? I mean, when you consider that, especially when you consider that after the next election, I mean, judging by the polls, the next, no matter who the leader of the Liberal Party is, he's going to be ending up sitting in opposition. Do you have any insights into that?
Well, like I said, I'm thinking about things from the standpoint of the systemic breakdown of the banking system that is going to have all sorts of nonlinear reverberations that will put the world into a deep crisis situation. And I think kind of like what we saw with Hitler's Enabling Act of 1933 that were only able to be done because of the burning down of the Reichstag. That was sort of like the German 9/11 of 1933 as an inside job. It created the excuse to get rid of parliamentary and other democratic programs of the Weimar Republic, such that a management by emergency decree by an empire-run type of system, you know, with a strong man at the helm, was able to be introduced as a solution. I get the sense that a similar sort of thing is going to be done as an excuse with the collapsing system, or maybe some other form of, or some combination of other inside job. There's a variety of cyber attacks or other things that have been gained out at the World Economic Forum that could also usher in an excuse to say, okay, it's a crisis time. The time for democracy is over. The time for strength and unified front, you know, where everybody marches in lockstep is now. And I think that Justin Trudeau is an empty shell of the nothing he can't be trusted by his handlers to be in uncontrolled situations, to debate people who think differently than him. He can only be in very, very tightly controlled environments because he has nothing going on inside. He's kind of like a male version of Kamala Harris. Whereas Mark Carney, I believe, is more scary in some ways because he's much more competent. He's much more rigorous. He can be trusted to be in the same room with, like, let's say, a Vladimir Putin or a Xi Jinping without having handlers managing everything that's being said. He's got a rigor about him, a viciousness about him, and a soft-spoken squareness about his persona as well, which gives off the vibe of being a little bit harmless or. But he's, again, I think that there's all of these things as a vicious technocrat going, that they would like to have somebody like him at the helm of the ship going into the next phase of turmoil, which will, I think, see a highly reduced set of democratic standards than we've been used to in our already very weakened democracy of the West.
Yeah, I'm going to call this our last question. We've got to wrap it up pretty soon. But, I mean, right now Trump is the president of the United States, and he's going to be bowing out of the climate agreement. And I think the next leader of the of Canada, you know, in the next year probably will be Pierre Poilievre, who's all against the green financing system. But do you really believe that the likelihood that this green finance initiative will succeed in spite of the bent of all the major the direction that the future leaders seem to be going?
I suspect not. It does kind of require all of the major nations of the world to be on board, and it also needs, for it to succeed, it needs legally binding mechanisms, which so far they've attempted it since COP14, really, in 2009. There's been an ongoing obsessive effort every year to try to get nations to sign on to things that will create legal enforcement mechanisms, which have always been resisted. Obviously, the EU folks, certain technocrats in North America push for it, want it. But the countries, both the majority of the global south, as well as China, India, Russia, have all said no. They're willing to pay lip service to a lot of these things. They'll play the game. They'll say the language. They'll do certain little things, but under no circumstance have they allowed that type of supranational enforcement mechanism to be created. And I don't think that they will. And without that consensus, I don't think that anything that they're trying to do around this COP29 agenda is going to be viable. I have my doubts that Poilievre is going to be brought in. I think that something different is probably going to happen, only because Canada's program. I don't think we're a sovereign country. We've always been a chess piece for the British Empire, in my assessment, and I've written about this in my book series.
Yeah.
Our role has been to create counterweights, and that's what Pierre Elliott Trudeau described as his foreign policy, is the creation of counterweights. We're a middle power, and so if there's whatever is the character of the United States, our assignment or the type of persona assigned to be prime minister has always been to offset that U.S. character. And if there's an orientation towards some restoration of industrial values that we see and hope that Trump will be bringing about, I don't necessarily see that Canada under will be permitted to have a similar pro-industrial perspective that I possibly Poilievre might be oriented towards. But I don't know. I could be wrong. I could very well be wrong.
Appreciate this discussion we had today. Thank you so much for participating.
Oh, my pleasure.
We've been speaking to Montreal-based journalist, author, and researcher Matthew Errett. You could read his work at the site CanadianPatriot.org. You're listening to the Global Research NewsHour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearch.ca. SearchNewsHour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.